This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
A hidden thread connects many of today's most important news stories, from warrantless wiretapping and the U.S. attorney firings to torture and the political struggle over the future of the Iraq War. These and other contentious issues in both foreign and domestic policy stem from the Bush administration's concerted and relentless efforts to increase presidential power. From its first day in office, the administration has been guided by Vice President Dick Cheney's ambition of permanently strengthening the Oval Office, not just for Bush, but for all future presidents. My guest is Charlie Savage. He is the National Legal Affairs correspondent for the Boston Globe, focusing on 9/11 issues. He graduated from Harvard College and holds a Master of Studies in Law from Yale Law School. He is also a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and his new book is Takeover: The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. Charlie, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. Hey, I've been looking forward to this, and it's a fantastic book.
Thank you.
The best place to start is tell folks what the book is about and what it's not about, because I don't want the folks to get the wrong impression from the title.
Yeah, it does have a very aggressive title. I did wanted to title it something a little bit drier, like the Cheney Project or something, and the book company urged me strongly to have something that might make people pick it up in the bookstore. But the book itself is much more detached than journalistic, if you will. What it is it's a broad-ranging description and investigation into the many ways that the Bush administration has expanded the powers of the presidency. It looks at rising secrecy, incidents and memos and events that established a right to bypass laws and treaties, the choices for the Supreme Court that this administration has made, picking presidential lawyers who share their very broad view of a president's inherent constitutional power to take actions independent of what Congress might have set up as far as statutory rules, and on and on and on. The use of signing statements and the greater controls over the executive branch bureaucracy, which is where that Justice Department, quote, politicization, unquote, comes in. All of these things, these controversies, have come from, in part, an overall agenda that was in place long before 9/11. At the very first meeting of the White House counsel's office in January 2001, after the inauguration, future Attorney General, then White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, conveyed to the White House legal team instructions. The instructions were that the president wanted them to seek out opportunities over the next 4 or 8 years to seize, protect, and expand powers for the presidency, because the president thought that his office had been weakened and it was time to roll back the limits that had been imposed in recent years and expand this power out again. And so early fights, like the fight over Cheney's Energy Task Force papers and whether the White House would have to turn those records over to Congress and to the public, also stemmed from this agenda before anyone was thinking about the war on terrorism.
Now, Charlie, what's interesting in your book is you really demonstrate how it wasn't really George Bush from Texas who brought that vision and that agenda to the table, to the White House. It was Dick Cheney, and it actually was a holdover from the Nixon White House.
Yes, this is, I don't agree with those who sort of sneer that, oh, Bush isn't the real president. I think an awful lot of what this administration has done clearly comes out of Bush's own background and experiences, No Child Left Behind, the immigration reform he was trying to push through, and the sort of hostility to gay marriage. These are all things that you would expect a former Texas governor who had tried to reform the education system in Texas and so forth to try to do. But this agenda, this executive power agenda, does not relate to anything in George's background. It instead relates to stuff in Vice President Cheney's background. Specifically, for 30 years earlier, in the 1970s, Dick Cheney was 33 years old, and he was the chief of staff to President Ford after Richard Nixon had to resign to avoid being impeached. He had been a mid-level Nixon administration official, and then he rose to the top of the executive branch hierarchy in the Ford administration. This was the period after Watergate and in Vietnam in which Congress had reawakened after years of slumber in which presidents had been taking on more power, the so-called imperial presidency. as Arthur Schlesinger Jr. called it. Congress was performing oversight again, and it was passing all kinds of laws that were intended to make sure that the president only used his powers for what he was supposed to use them for and not to abuse them. You know, checks and balances were being restored, and the constitutional equilibrium was coming back. Inside the White House, this looked like a siege. It was an outrage. And when you go to the Ford Presidential Library and you look through Dick Cheney's, then you can see that he thought that this was going to damage the country by making the president weaker than the president should be. He thought the proper amount of power was this imperial power that Nixon had briefly tried to wield. So he would spend the next 30 years talking very openly and pushing for greater flexibility for the presidency to roll back these reforms that he thought had gone too far. He tried in Congress. He defended the White House's actions during the Iran-Contra scandal. He tried as Secretary of Defense to get the first George Bush to launch the Gulf War without going to Congress in order to show that the president as commander-in-chief could do something like that. He failed to get the first President Bush to take that advice, but as vice president, he was able to convince the second President Bush to embrace this agenda, and it became a central operating principle throughout this administration.
Winner of the 2007 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting, Charlie Savage covers national legal affairs for the Boston Globe. We're discussing his new book, Takeover: The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. Charlie, what do you think are the most egregious examples of this effort to increase the power of the White House that we've seen under the Bush administration?
Well, I wouldn't want to use a word like egregious. What I'm trying to do, again, despite this aggressive title, is to be very descriptive. This is what's happening, and here's the legal context, here's the characters and the narrative, and who are the people doing this, what's their background, what's their motivation, but then leave it at that.
Fair enough, but what have been the acts then that have received the most condemnation?
Well, the president's decision to authorize the military to wiretap Americans' phone calls without getting warrants is a classic example. It often gets muddled in this sort of political argument. Well, don't you want to listen to Osama bin Laden's phone calls? Isn't that necessary after 9/11? That's not the question. The question is, if there's a law on the books that says the executive branch must get warrants when it's going to wiretap. This is one of those post-Watergate reforms because Nixon and Johnson before him had abused that power by spying on their domestic enemies. They said, we're going to have a check and balance. The judge is going to make sure that this is, in fact, a legitimate counterterrorism or counter-espionage investigation. Maybe that rule didn't make sense anymore after 9/11. Maybe, on policy grounds, the rule ought to have been changed. But the legal question was, can a president on his own decide that a law doesn't make sense anymore and simply ignore it? Or does he have to go to Congress and get the law to be changed? That is a sort of a paradigmatic example, but it goes all over the place. The establishment of military commissions without congressional consultation, the freeing of interrogators to use harsh interrogation techniques, what some would call torture, even though there's ratified treaties and laws that said that could not be done. The pulling out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty without going to the Senate, as the tradition had been, and many other examples like this. The holding of U.S. citizens without trial by naming them as enemy combatants is a major departure from the way that the country had been run up until sort of this modern era. And I want to pause here to make a very important point. And you sort of asked me at the beginning of this, what is this book, what is this book not? This book adopts the tone as it describes all these things and investigates them and sort of lays them out in a narrative way as from the prism that executive power is a politically neutral phenomenon. It is not a partisan issue. Why? Because in the past and again in the future, this country will have both Republican and Democratic presidents, both conservative and liberal presidents. These future presidents who are going to be stronger because of this effort are going to be able to cite these precedents to take their own actions in controversies that we can't even conceive of now, 10 years, 50 years from now. They're going to be able to use these same powers for their own ends, whether or not those are conservative or liberal. And this book itself has been endorsed by a number of very prominent conservatives. The columnist George Will has endorsed this book. Mickey Edwards, the former Republican congressman and former head of the American Conservative Union, has endorsed this book. Richard Epstein, who's one of the most prominent conservative law professors in the country at the University of Chicago, said this is correct. Whether you're liberal or conservative, executive power kind of rises above the policy disputes that normally divide this country, and is an issue for everyone to think about. what is it that the founders were trying to do when they established a system of checks and balances that prevented the concentration of unchecked power in anybody's hands? Why did they think that was necessary, having fought a war to get rid of a king? Why did they want a system that was based on the principle that you had to have rules for the executive that were set by people outside the executive, the elected Congress, and that the executive was bound to obey those rules as he carried out his duties?
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Charlie Savage. His new book is Takeover. And speaking of the founders, that was my next question. How does this agenda and the acts taken by the Bush administration over the last few years, how do they square with what the founders had intended? Because, you know, they had this debate in the 1770s, and some of those folks wanted a king, and they lost the debate.
Well, that's absolutely right. The founding fathers, when they wrote the Constitution in 1787 to 1789, were very deliberate in creating a system by which power would be divided and shared among co-equal branches as a means of preventing a president from getting out of control and becoming a king. Why? Because they had a very realistic view of human nature. They just, you know, England had a lousy king before the American Revolution. If he'd have been a benevolent dictator, as it were, there probably would not have been an American Revolution. But they knew that, you know, people are flawed, that from time to time people get into positions of great authority, even though that they, you know, are misguided or incompetent or even corrupt. And they wanted a system that would constrain a bad leader from basically driving the country off the rails. And that's how they, you know, depending on your politics, you may think George Bush is a bad leader, you may think Bill Clinton's a bad leader, but everyone probably agrees that we've had some bad leaders from time to time. The system is designed to minimize the damage by making sure that no one had all the levers of power at their disposal, that they had to obey a system in which outsiders were checking and balancing their actions.
Charlie, what are your thoughts when you hear somebody say, well, you know, that's all well and good, but we're up against an enemy now that we've never seen before, this is a war we've never fought, and if America is to survive, perhaps we need an imperial president?
Well, there's a couple things to say about that. One is, as I've emphasized earlier, that although 9/11 provided a tremendous excuse for or vehicle for throwing this agenda into overdrive, and a lot of the controversies that surrounded national security, this is bigger than the war on terrorism. It predated 9/11, and it has to do with things that have nothing to do with national security, like can Congress pass laws that, you know, regulate the executive branch, that give lower officials the right to do something the president might not want them to do, the responsibility to do something the president might not want them to do, or forbids them from doing things the president might want to do, well beyond the national security sphere. So this is not just about, oh, we're facing Al-Qaeda now. But beyond that, this goes back to the founders' idea of how American-style democracy was supposed to work. You know, there are a lot of hard questions that are raised by a situation like we're in now. Let's take the question of torture. Should we torture routinely? I mean, everyone brings up the ticking time bomb scenario, but that's fiction. That doesn't happen. Well, the question is, we know we've got hundreds of guys in our prisons, and maybe one of them knows something, and we're not sure which one it is, but possibly they know something that might prevent some attack that we don't know about. How are we going to get that information out of them? Should we use conventional questioning methods, or should we torture them? So this raises questions like, you know, is torture ethical? Does it actually work? Is it counterproductive because it creates such a backlash, or because people say anything to make the suffering stop, and so you think you know something, but it's really false information, like Saddam was working with Al-Qaeda or something like that? These are hard questions, and it's hard decisions to make. And the question is, who decides? Under the American system of government that the founders envisioned, they wanted Congress to make the rules. They did not want the same person who is running the government to decide what rules and what limits he will have to obey and what he won't. And so that kind of checks and balances, and sort of the insight into human nature behind it, the idea that there, you know, there is no Jack Bauer out there who is going to always make the right decision and is only going to beat up the right guy, in real life people are flawed and they're working with imperfect information, and so we have to design rules for that. The founder's insight that the person, the body that should be making those decisions is separate from the body that's going to be carrying them out, is what American democracy is all about.
Hey, Charlie, you got about a minute left. What is it you think that most Americans don't get or don't understand about the Bush administration that you have spent years writing about and studying? What is it we don't get?
Well, you know, I think people think, well, isn't this what presidents always do? Presidents always try to push the envelope. Clinton did some stuff. Reagan did some stuff. Lincoln certainly did things in the Civil War and so forth. What's different about this? And what I'm trying to demonstrate in this book is that it's true, as the founders knew, that people in power always are trying to, you know, do achieve their agenda by any means necessary. But what Takeover describes is a dramatic escalation or intensification of this normal dynamic, because it stemmed from a conscious agenda as an end to itself, separate from any policy goal, and it was aimed at leaving behind a stronger institution for future presidents as well. And it was enabled by some political contingencies, 9/11, one-party control of government, that broke down the normal countervailing forces and succeeded in moving presidential power much, much further down the field than you would normally see. Because presidential power acts like a one-way ratchet, because it's easier to increase than it is to roll back again, this is achieving a sort of permanent transformation of how our democracy works that future presidents, liberal and conservative alike, are going to be able to draw on. We haven't been talking about this. We ought to pay attention to it and at least debate it, ask the 2008 presidential candidates what they think about it. That's what this book is intended to achieve.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author, reporter, Charlie Savage. The new book is Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. Charlie, it's been an honor to talk to you. It's a fascinating book.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.